Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Just before the big interview with Jamie Murray, I'd like to tell you about our Socio Club. By signing up at patreon.com/GrahamHunter for $2.99 a month, you can get access to all of Graham's shows in full and ad-free. That includes socio-only big interviews with Ledley King and Rafa van der Vaart, and, coming very soon, Robbie Keane. Socios also get Graham's weekly magazine show, The Big Inside View, and much more. Head to patreon.com/GrahamHunter.
Jamie Murray is not only a two-time Wimbledon champion, but the first Murray to win Wimbledon. Hello, Jamie. Andy, sorry, he started it. He's an Australian Open winner and one of the best doubles players in the world. But what about his other sporting achievements? Well, you've come to the right place. In this big interview, Jamie reveals that he once held the world championship belt in wrestling, beating in the final his brother Andy in a ladder match, had there only been cameras there. Jamie is also an exceptional footballer and once gave Brazil international Hulk the full runaround in a game of football tennis. Here, Murray Sr. talks about honing his skills at a park in Dunblane and falling in love with the brand of football played by Sir Alex Ferguson's Manchester United. Hibs' Scottish Cup final victory in 2016 pops up, and our guest also picks his perfect five-a-side team from tennis's ATP Tour. It's not bad. Enjoy this. I don't think, Jamie Murray, I've ever spoken to a Wimbledon champion or a US Open champion before. In fact, I don't spend a lot of time talking to the tennis world, so given that you're a world leader and a Scot, it's a very proud moment for me. And if I took you back to childhood in Dunblane, I set you a challenge. Say, for example, you had to fashion out some kind of belt that signified that you might be world champion, perhaps even in wrestling. Let's say a WWF. Yeah.
You've been doing your homework.
WWF, like, are in the States. I've just come back from the States. I phoned them and said, listen, Steve Austin, man, I've got Jamie Murray on his couch. Right? And Steve said, listen, I'll tell you what I ask him, man.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. We used to be right into the wrestling, me and Andy and some of our friends. Yeah, we'd be watching it like every Friday night. Yeah, and we went once to down in Newcastle, and yeah, make up the belts, and we're just with like cardboard and like tin foil and stuff.
So wait, this is a full, listen, you're talking to a Blue Peter fanatic here, okay? So we're talking about actually constructing.
It wasn't winning awards on Blue Peter, I tell you that, but
it looked like a belt. It looked like a world championship WWF belt, right?
Yeah.
Done with detail, done with attention and care.
Yeah, definitely, yeah, because, you know, you want to be proud when you raise it up high. You know, announcing to your brother that you're the new world heavyweight champion.
Yes, man, I'm taking this a good deal more seriously than you are. I'm impressed, I think this is kudos, man. This should go on the CV.
Yeah.
If you ever got to go for a straight job, they won't just ask you about the tennis, they'll ask you about arts and crafts. They just will. So, like, the WWF passion came into the house, right?
Yep.
So, just describe it a little bit.
Well, I mean, we probably watched it for a good, like, 5 or 6 years, up until we're maybe, like, 15. If my dad was here, he'd probably be saying 25, but it was about 15, yeah. But it was huge at that time, because you had, like, Stone Cold Steve Austin, you had The Rock. Undertaker was huge. Like, you had massive stars, and Yeah, we were right into it, yeah. And, you know, we would, like all kids, we'd be, like, practicing the moves on each other and, you know, not necessarily doing, like power bombs and that sort of thing. But, you know, we'd get a few moves out and, yeah, put, like, the duvets on the floor, pillows, that sort of stuff.
To make the ring?
Yeah, make a ring and just a bit extra padding for when you hit the deck, yeah. But, I mean, we loved it. We were right into it, had the, you know, the wrestling games on the Nintendos or whatever. Yeah, it was massive. Yeah, I mean, I used to just love, like, the storylines. Like, back in those days, it was really good, yeah. But nowadays, I think it's changed quite a lot, wrestling, I think.
This is what I say about music to my girls. Like, nah, you can't hear the words. Yeah. Like, it's rubbish now, man. They're like, Dad, it's always been like this.
Yeah.
But, so yeah, it's the theatre, partly.
Yeah, I like the storylines, how it was all playing out, and... Like The Rock, I mean, he was brilliant TV. I mean, he still is. Like, so much charisma, and he was so, like, naturally funny. I mean, Stone Cold as well, like, in his feuds with Vince McMahon and those guys. I mean, for me, I just loved it. I thought it was brilliant. It was just pure entertainment. And for us as kids, like, that was the best.
I have to tell you, I'm a big brother, and, like, you know, I generally kind of used height and weight as a kid.
Right.
How did you fare as big brothers? You had an advantage. Did you win all the time?
Well, no. I mean, we always laugh because, like, even if Andy tells a story, he's like, the only belt I would let him win would be the woman's belt. But he seemed quite happy, you know? He was fine. We had, like, two or three belts. I don't know if we went that far. I don't know if he deserved the belt for that, but we didn't really, like, fight, you know, in anger, really. I think we just kind of, like, we were both just enjoying it, messing around. And I mean, to be honest, like, one day, you know, I would win, the next day he would win. And, you know, if, like, thinking back now, just, I mean, it's so silly, isn't it? But
I don't,
you know, you're
so
on the ground and you're, like, you know, you're pinning your brother, and it's like, you know, you get the one count, the two count.
Of
and
course
then,
you do.
It's that fun.
What's
to
the
me,
point
like,
in doing it unless you're giving it a one?
Yeah. It was fun. It was a fun childhood.
In our days, it was Kendo Nagasaki, and can you get the mask off? Of course, it was like,
yeah, okay,
you know,
yeah,
a ring in Wigan with Dickie Davis waiting on it. It wasn't quite WWE. It didn't have The Rock, right? And the storylines weren't the same, but they were good fun for us. And what we had was, like, tag teams, and there would always be the villains, and they'd punch, and, you know, it'd be a scripted punch, but the crowd would go mad, and you'd hate the villains.
Yeah,
man.
Of course, yeah.
You wanted Sinclair to win, and Mick McManus or whatever, and Big Daddy against Haystack. So, listen, you know, you're talking to a believer here. So a believer, you know, at that stage, I was out trying to earn a living, so I didn't watch them all, but the concept of, is it a ladder match? I don't know what it is.
Yeah, ladder match. Yeah, we had a few of those. Yeah, like those.
You watched a few of those.
Well, no, we had our own. Yeah, like you'd have to climb the step ladder, and then you'd, like, ring the lampshade to earn the belt, earn the victory, or whatever. I guess that's creativity, isn't it? I mean, kids are like that. I mean, it's probably changed nowadays. Everyone's sitting on iPads and that
not
sort of thing.
To each other,
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Listen, you're talking to believe, and also, like, it begins at any stage. I'm talking about somebody who didn't go on to win Grand Slam titles. You know, we were competitive, and rough and tumble was a bit, and creativity is for us as kids in the garden all the time, making things up. You learn competitive skills that don't need to take you to world titles. You learn competitive skills doing that in play.
Yeah.
That will serve you in social situations or, you know, work situations throughout your life. And if you don't do it, you've got poorer childhood. That's the end of the story. So when you're down there and you've got him pinned down, or him, you, and you want to... The ring was being kept safe by duvets.
Yeah,
maybe
normally,
Aberdeen,
like, put
duvets
down duvets
or Liverpool or Manchester United, maybe. I asked because when you kindly said that you'd be happy to come on the big interview, the H word was mentioned. You know, you said if I could keep you off the subject of the Mighty High Beast, I'd be doing well. But, like, an ex-Scotland captain, an ex-great leader of Manchester United, Darren Fletcher, tells me you're a bit of a United man.
Yeah. I mean, I got into United probably when I was, like, 10, 11. I mean, they were the best team, so it was probably easy to, you know, as a kid to gravitate towards them. But, you know, as I got older, obviously, like, Sir Alex Ferguson being a huge, you know, Scottish icon, like, the football that they played as well was just, was so exciting to watch, wasn't it? And that, like, that was entertainment. Like, you knew when you went to Old Trafford or you were watching Man United on TV, you were going to be entertained. And with Darren, I mean, in my sort of lifetime, or certainly since I've been aware of football, I mean, Scotland's not really had a, like, real world-class player, which is a shame. But he's, like, achieved everything, hasn't he? I mean, mm-hmm. he played at Man United a long time, won pretty much everything there is to win in the game. And for me, he's, like, that's who you would look up to if you were a kid wanting to be a footballer from Scotland. He's the guy you would look to, because he was by far the most successful Scottish player we had, and, you know, playing in one of, like, the best teams of all time.
Even at that age, when you begin to discover Manchester United, you saw the fact that Sir Alex Ferguson, the leader, their general, the fact that he was Scottish, that at least engaged your interest, maybe became a source of inspiration. It was important to you he was a Scot.
Yeah, it's just like he's one of us, isn't he? And he's been, you know, taking on the world and doing amazing things at Manchester United, and, you know, just like his drive and his passion and determination to, you know, be successful and bring the whole club in the direction that he wants it to go, and making these guys, you know, go to battle for him every day and, you know, fight to the death to win. Like, it's an amazing talent to have that. I mean, how many people can say that they've really, really got that? And, you know, they just, like, they won everything, didn't they? It was incredible time for English football. And, you know, a lot of people, I bet, like, hate him, don't they? But that's because he's so successful, and I bet every single person that didn't like him would have wanted him to manage their club.
For sure, and I think that he represents an old Scotland where he was driven, and it was relentless. There was something about his upbringing. But to take more than that and look at what you said, to be able to motivate a group, you've spent your life having to either, maybe not motivate yourself, but drive yourself, be at it all the time,
yeah,
be
yeah.
the best all the time, which I'm guessing, although you've done it successfully, it isn't an easy art to be at it all the time personally. So if you can transfer that, looking back at him now, and thinking that he had to do that for a first team squad of 20 or 25, another 15 or 16 staff, then the youngsters, the board above him, and given your achievements in sport, you'd be able to begin to think about the size of his achievement.
Yeah, I mean, from my point of view, it's a lot easier just to look after one person. Yeah, just look after myself and, you know, each day prepare as best I can for my matches. And, you know, if we don't win, we're not getting paid, are we? So for us, there's always that motivation to be out there practicing, trying to get better, develop your game, and yeah, get out there and win matches, basically, because if you're not, then you're not making money, your rankings drop in, and you're not able to play in the tournaments that currently I'm able to play in.
So when, just let's, because people listening in love their football, at what stage do you remember noticing Manchester United or saying, that's the player I like, that's the brand of football, boy, what a match that was? Can you pick out the era, if not the minute? Who's playing in the first teams that you began to watch?
Like Bruce Pallister, Paul Parker, Paul Ince, Mark Hughes, Kanchelskis, is it?
Presumably Cantona.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're just beginning to win the league then in this stage.
Yeah, yeah. And then I think when I really started to become into, to get right into it was obviously when there was like the class of 92, all those guys were playing, young guys, doing brilliant things, becoming an amazing team. Yeah, and of course, like at that time, you know, Sky Sports was getting big in football, so, you know, you could start to follow it all the time, and I just loved it. Like, just loved the fact that they were just, you know, they were always at teams. They were always wanting the ball. They were always wanting to make things happen. It was always like, you know, attack, attack, attack. And, you know, the belief in the team that, you know, good things would always happen to them, and they would find a way to make it happen, to score that goal that, you know, in Fergie time that everyone always talks about, you know. And they would do what had to be done, and they did it in a way that was exciting to watch. Yeah.
What was football for you growing up? Because you were good at it and you enjoyed multi-sports. That's what we were talking about before the tape started, that it was by no means tennis all the way. Football, you played a bit.
Yeah, I mean, I played, like, you know, with friends, played a lot actually with my dad's kind of group of friends, playing five-a-side football, that sort of stuff.
At what age were you?
Probably from like 15 maybe. Started to play quite a lot with them. I mean, I always enjoyed it. I mean, who doesn't enjoy playing five-a-side football? Like, it's brilliant, isn't it? I mean, I was never, like, in danger of, you know, signing for Hibs and, you know, scoring 20 goals a season for them and getting them into the Champions League group stage or anything like that. But, you know,
I loved it. This is a recurring dream, isn't it? Yeah. You didn't just pluck that out of nowhere, either. What did you do? What was your touch? Left foot, right foot?
I was right footed.
Right footed.
Yeah. But not afraid to take it onto the left foot if that's what the situation demanded of me.
Right. Where were the courts? Dunblane?
Yeah, we put a bit at Dunblane. I mean, like, we would go, like, me and Andy and our friends, we would always walk over to our park, the local park just next where my gran lives. And we would just play like headers and volleys there. You had like two big trees, and we would just go to town. Like, we'd get back from school, just go over and play and enjoy it. But then, like, now you can't play ball games there because the residents stuff complain about noise. But it's just sad, you know.
It's sad. It's a crime.
Everyone's like 80 years old there as well. They probably can't even hear it, but they see the kids and they just think, nah, don't want that.
There's a campaign which in Aberdeen, all the no-ball games are being torn down and reduced by yes-ball games everywhere.
Oh, that's cool, yeah.
It's the... I don't know if you've read it, but in the when I went back in Chabby's lifestyle, he lived in Terrassa. They talked really... There was a brilliant TV programme. We talked emotionally, just about the same way as you're doing, about having played in the town square, and there were flowers and fast, you know, busy roads and all. And it's keep the ball, start... Because A, it was concrete, you know, when I fall down. B, the flower beds, you get your... arse kicked if you put there was a rot, so the keep the ball started there, and he went back to the same square in Terrassa where he lives, and there was a big, you know, this World Cup winner, you know, his site had been taken away in Prohibido, you know, and now there's a recognition in Spain that can't be right too. But when you were doing that, when you were playing that, was the purpose to win, or did you said it was crosses and volleys and headers. Did you do it again and again until you could do something spectacularly? And
I mean, it wasn't, for us, it wasn't about who's winning. It's like, who's scoring the best volley, innit? Or overhead kick, or, you know, crossing it in and, you know, bullet header or whatever. I never liked going in goals because I was, like, hopeless at diving. So I was, like, always kind of determined not to end up there. I hate putting the gloves on, like, big sweaty gloves, your hands stink afterwards. I wasn't into that at all, Didn't like getting my clothes dirty or my knees covered in mud, like wasn't for me. And I remember, like, you get a new football, and, you know, we'd be walking over to the park, like, no chance that's been bounced on the ground or anything. That's like, I want it to be as new for as long as possible.
What is it made of? Wasn't a leather ball, was it?
No, like mitre, mitre, Adidas, but we just used to love it. Like, we had a great setup because we walk 2 minutes to the sports club, tennis courts, and the golf club, and just across the road was a park. So we could do, like, whatever we wanted, really. And in, like, this summer, it's brilliant in Scotland because it's light till 10:30 at night, isn't it? You can play and play and play. So we loved growing up there. Yeah, it's brilliant.
So there's genes running through because your dad was a decent footballer and your grandfather's a good footballer, right?
I don't know about my dad being a decent footballer, but my grandpa, he was...
What now?
He's all right.
What?
He still plays five-a-side now, and he's like 60-odd years old.
That's still not gets, bad.
Yeah, he does all right, yeah.
Did you play like him, or did you take after your grandfather, or what?
More movement than my dad, I think.
Oh, this is.
I mean, I've never seen my grandpa play, so I don't know what maybe his best attributes were, but obviously he'd been talked about. So.
The legend goes that he was keener on tennis and didn't like heading the ball at granddad, but like you've turned out, he was a professional footballer.
Yeah, that's he played for Stirling Albion. He was at Hibs for a bit. Yeah, he was obviously a decent player, like centre half. Yeah.
And was it down to him? I mean, you've got to mention Hibs, I suppose.
Back in the big leagues now.
Now listen, I'm old enough to remember when they were any good. you should listen to, I don't know if you listen to Neil Lennon talking about, he's a smashing talker, great fun podcast, and good singer too, so that one's worth a listen, definitely.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
Why Hibs? Take us back to...
Well, because my grandpa played for them, so like all of my mum's side of the family, they supported Hibs. And we used to get taken along all the time when we were kids. We'd go to Easter Road or, well, in Scotland, doesn't matter. I mean, we lived so centrally, so to drive to most of the grounds was, you know, within an hour you could get to pretty much everywhere except Pittodrie, probably.
So you'd follow them on the road sometimes?
Yeah, we'd go to St Johnstone, go to Dundee. Airdrie, Falkirk's like 20 minutes.
Maybe not to the old firm clubs when you were younger.
We went to Rangers game once at Ibrox, and I started crying when the players ran out because of the noise. I wasn't used to the noise, and just got me. Yeah, I was only like 19 at the time. Yeah, I was probably like 7 or 8 or something. And just like, it wasn't ready for that. And I mean, Hibs probably got humped as well. But
where are the ones? Because, you know, we share a player way before you. But Joe Hart, my first memory of Hibs is not because Eddie Turnbull, who won the Cup in 1970 for us, the manager, he was a great, great Hibs legend. He'd been at Hibs before I was born. But Joe Harper, playing for us, went to, who's our, you know, our god, just our best ever player. You, a Marinello, or I don't know who it is now, or Keith Wright, or whoever you are. Yeah. And when he didn't work out Everton, he went to Hibs. And boy, I grew up hating Hibs, because King Joey was there, and you were looking at your watch until we got him back. And when he came back, man, it was heaven. So, yeah, I was 12, 13, 14. You know, I'd never known happiness like it when we got him back. So my first ones were Arthur Graham, Joe Harper, whatever. So when the players who really mattered to you when you start following, who are the guys, when you go there going like, we're at Falkirk, we're at St Johnstone, don't want to lose, the guy who'll get us through today is?
I mean, Frank Sauzé was probably the best player I saw playing for Hibs. Russell Latipi. He was great when he was there.
He knew what the ball was for, wasn't he?
Yeah. Yeah, these guys were proper players. And we had, I mean, before that, I mean, guys like Michael O'Neill, he was great at Hibs. Because we used to sit in like the family stand, so we were like really close to the pitch, and he was obviously a winger, so he would always be like right next to us. And he was really skillful. Mickey Weir, like Darren Jackson as well. Like,
good footballer, yeah, actually. Really good footballer.
Good player. Played for Scotland.
What was the experience of Easter Road and Leith and getting to the game like? Because, you know, that's something that's embellished in my memory as a youngster. It felt like, you know, a palace doesn't even... You know, Pittodrie felt like heaven.
Yeah.
When I was a kid.
Used to love going. I just always remember having to, like, park and then... You know, it always seemed like a long walk to get to the stadium, but yeah, just like getting there, going through the turnstiles, you know, trying to get like your pack of crisps or whatever and your drink, and yeah, I remember that stuff. It was just great fun, like getting up and on a Saturday morning, getting ready to go for the game, driving through you know, see your team. It's your team, isn't it? That's what's exciting about it. You know, win, lose, or draw. Like you still love them. You still want them to do great. And you know, you'll be back. You'll be back next week. Like even if they lose 5-0, like life goes on, doesn't it? Just keep scoring and yeah, just used to love it. Yeah. Not when Airdrie came though, because Airdrie always beat us. And they had like loads of ex-Hearts players in their team as well, so that was always a rough one. That was like the ultimate bogey team, and then it kind of became Livingston for a while as well. Could never beat them. Hampden as well, like lost them a few times there.
I was going to say as well, we need to look at some cup finals. 2012, we'll just draw a complete veil over. There were six goals in the match, shared evenly between two Edinburgh sides. John Collins won the League Cup. I don't know where...
I was there when they won in 1990.
No.
Yeah, I was there, yeah.
Keith Wright.
In the terraces, yeah, we beat Dunfermline.
Yeah. John Budgie Burridge in goals.
Yeah, we had to... I got taken away just before the game finished because there was like so many... I mean, we were really... I mean, I was only 4 or 5 years old then. And of course, it was going to, I guess, start kicking off and everyone's celebrating. It was all... standing then, so we left before the final whistle went, just to avoid all that.
Are the memories of the day, do you think, imagined memories, or do you think there's, because when you talk about standing, yeah, the size you must have had, what were you,
yeah,
five,
I mean,
four?
I kind of, yeah, we're, yeah,
because those terraces moved,
yeah, I mean,
20-30 feet sometimes,
yeah. I kind of remember sort of being like perched on the barrier, the railing, yeah. I mean, I don't remember anything about the game at all. I just remember kind of being in the stands.
It kind of takes us up to the year before last. Where were you when the 100 and whatever year hoodoo?
Yeah, well, I was on court practicing at the French Open, and was just kind of like was following it on my phone. You know, when we were taking like water breaks, and I knew it was 2-2, and then one of the Scottish journalists, he came like trudging over. And I was like, Stu, what's the score? And he goes, you don't know. I said, no, I don't know. He goes, it's 3-2 to the Hibs. He's like, they scored in the last minute. He was a Rangers fan. And I couldn't believe it. I was like, no way. Because, you know, it's like, it's Hibs. We always guff it. You know, when we get to Hampden or whatever, so many bad experiences over the years. But, you know, to finally do it. Like, I mean, I would love to have been there. And a lot of my family were, but... As I always say, like, I'd rather have missed the game and Hibs won than be there and potentially lose. So that was...
Was it vital? It was a tournament that you had to be at.
Yeah,
like,
it was Grand Slam, yeah.
There's so no little devil in your mind saying, I'm just going to go.
No, and look, to be honest, probably deep down didn't think they were going to do it either.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, no, I know the feeling. And so when do you get to see the goal and then, I mean... Listen, I'm a romantic, total romantic, Jamie, and I was only teasing before about Hibs. I see the attraction over the years, and over the years, I've enjoyed watching them an awful lot. But at the end, when everybody's singing Sunshine on Leith, for me, that's one of the most iconic moments in Scottish football.
Yeah.
Maybe in Scottish sport in my lifetime.
Yeah.
It's literally a story. I kind of feel...
It's a great song, though, isn't it? It's so, like, so well known to... Or so associated with Hibs, yeah. My grandpa, my mum said he was crying when they were singing it. Like he was just loving it.
But it was emotional.
Yeah, I bet it was.
But,
yeah.
No, even,
I mean, I've watched it like on social media and stuff. Yeah. I mean, it always like, yeah, it gets the hairs on your back of the neck going. That's true.
Well, only in Scotland, it's Hibs against Rangers. They don't particularly like each other.
Yeah.
Rangers are favoured. It's a late winner, almost a last-minute winner. Fans, whoever fans it was, come on the pitch.
Yeah,
there's a bit of a rammy. It's very Scottish. They all get heard it back, and that's a wee sing-song now.
Yeah,
I tell you, only in Scotland.
Yeah,
and then it's like poetry. It's like some sort of social. I don't know what it was, and beauty of the moment, the perfect song, and it's not really a football song either. And the players are there just. It wasn't even the players with the cup who took centre stage. It was the fans behind the goal.
Yeah, it was I mean, like, I obviously wasn't there. I would have loved to have been there, having looked back and seen the result. But I'm sure for, like, every single Hibs fan, I mean, there's been a lot of pain in Hampden and cup finals, cup semi-finals and stuff, like, to finally get over the finish line, like, to beat Rangers as well, it's always nice. Like, yeah, it's not going to get better for them than that, is it? I mean, it's an incredible moment for the club.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The thing that really interests me is that when you spend your life watching or talking about Scottish sport, we seem to have, in general, this gene about quite liking failure, or at least liking to glorify in nearlies.
Yeah, yeah. Britain in general, I think, is like that. I don't think it's just a Scottish thing. I think the British culture is kind of that way inclined, unfortunately, but.
You immediately recognise what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. I mean, people, well, they love that story, don't they? Like, the, you know, tried really hard, came so close, but ultimately, you know, it was all in vain. And, you know, the papers all write about it. And, yes, yeah, I don't know, like, we're not really good at sort of celebrating winners in our culture, I don't think.
Can I ask you then, are we good at setting out to be winners, even before we try to celebrate winners? I think what I'm building up to ask, and I'm not looking for university theory, but you, your brother, your mum, amongst others, and you mentioned Darren too, clearly buck the trend for a lot of reasons, not simply because of the success, but because of attitude, because of perfectionism, because of ambition, because of mentality. But I wonder, and I genuinely mean it's tossed up to be kicked away if you disbelieve it, is it about us having some inbuilt gene that we actually really like the romance of, oh, we nearly did it, we were brilliant, and then somebody got in the way, the referee, the wind, somebody fell over, somebody missed a penalty kick? Or is it that we actually don't set out in the first place to prepare well enough with the right mentality, the right belief?
There probably is a bit of, like, small-time mentality, I think. For us growing up, like, I don't know, maybe we just felt it. But, like, we, or certainly I did, I shouldn't say we, but I did. Like, but then maybe that was just the way that it was sold to us by, maybe by my mum, that everything is against you. So, you know, we didn't have, like, up in Scotland, trying to be a tennis player is almost impossible to do it. And, you know, the setup is against us, mm-hmm. to survive and go on and do, you know, become professional tennis players. And, you know, we probably grew up with that, and, you know, we're always fighting to, you know, to get ahead, and, you know, maybe, you know, we don't want to, you know, these people, they don't want us to be successful, they don't want us to win. And, you know, maybe, like, we develop, like, a sort of, you know, a steel and a determination to succeed and kind of show those people that, you know what, like, yeah, we're better than you, we're from Scotland, whatever, we'll show you. And it was probably from a young age, you know, like, we had to always travel down to England to compete, mm-hmm. because we didn't have opportunities up in Scotland. There weren't tournaments, there weren't enough players. So, you know, every weekend we'd be driving down to England, we'd finish school, get in the car, drive down to England, 4 or 5 hours, compete on the weekend, drive back home, go to school, train, and then Friday do it again. That's what we had to do. So it was a lot harder for us than it was for the English kids, that's for sure. And I think almost in a way, like, the strong will survive in that situation, because those who don't have the kind of desire to keep doing that, because it's a huge commitment, not just from us as kids, but from your parents as well, like, and the coaches to, you know, you've given up so much time to do that. And both our parents, they were doing full-time jobs. And then obviously on the weekends, driving down to England to watch us play tennis. So you need that commitment. And, you know, I think we were sold on the idea that, you know, it is difficult. You know, we're not getting any help. It's not going to be easy for you, but, you know, let's just do it. Let's just show everyone that, you know, we are better than them. We can be players. And, you know, I think that did help develop, you know, certain character traits that we probably needed to be successful in professional sport, I think.
A couple of things spring to mind. When you're putting so much into it, and you can see your parents putting so much into it, does it make you more determined not to give less than your best? Would you know, the drive back when
Now, obviously, I'm older and grown up, like, and you're a bit more aware of, you know, the sacrifices that your parents made. Like, you know, I'll have gone down to tournaments and, you know, not given my best effort, or, you know, acted like a twat or whatever, and just, you know, been a disaster. And, you know, then I'm thinking, like, oh my God, I wonder what my mum or my dad was thinking, like, at that time. Like, how could you do that after all the effort that they've gone to get you to, you know, Hull for the weekend to play a junior tournament? Like, it is remarkable. But I obviously, at the time, and you're kind of doing it, you're not thinking about that side of things.
There was a stage where I saw you saying, and I just always trust that the quote is true, I think I did have a great talent to do good things in tennis, but it took me a long time to understand how best to use it, to understand what it took to be a performer, to turn up each day and to do what needed to be done to perform well on that particular day. I think when you're talking about something like that in any sport, particularly when you get to your elite level, I don't think that's a really easy thing to learn.
No, I mean, I'm 31 now. I've been playing tennis since I was 4 years old, and probably only in the last sort of 2-3 years probably really started to understand what it takes to be a performer and, you know, to do what you need to do regardless of the situation, and just, you know, stay in the moment, just play point by point, not worrying about the finish line or what's happened the points before, or, you know, maybe I've just lost match points or I've missed an easy smash, to, you know, I'm now break point down or whatever. Just, it's been just park it and just, okay, now stepping up to the baseline, play my serve, going to come to net, going to play my volley, and then after that, like, what happens, happens. And it's a really, really, really difficult skill to master, to learn. It certainly took me long enough. I mean, obviously, you know, still going to have days where, you know, get a bit panicky or, you know, mind's racing and, you know, start getting stressed out about this or that, the other thing. But I think, like, one of the main reasons that I've been able to be successful the last sort of 2-3 years is because I've been able to do that, being able to put in a good, solid performance day in, day out. Of course, some days you'll play great, some days you'll play bad. But for the most part of the year, you'll kind of play good, and it's finding a way on those days to win as opposed to lose that's going to make or break your career.
See, it might be because I'm not that bright, but it seems to me that in what you've just described, and in any sports person at your level, there's a real dichotomy, because by going over the points, the match, the day that you haven't done well, by rehashing it, assimilating it, breaking it down, working on it, you learn, you grow. But equally, you must, in a point, or in a rally, or in a match, or in a set, or that day-by-day thing, you also have to learn to just close the steel vault and shut that learning process. The same learning process where you can assimilate the errors and grow and change, is sometimes the thing that you have to just lock out, as you've just described, completely. So knowing which day is a day to just lock it out, and which day is a day to stop and learn and grow, that.
Yeah.
So have I described that correctly? Is that what you have to do sometimes?
Yeah, I think like in the moment, yeah, you're out there and you're competing in it, and it's happening. Like you have to sometimes just put the brakes on and yeah, like I said, just park it. Enough is enough. It's 5-all. If you're not playing good and it's still 5-all, then your opponent can't be playing that good either. Otherwise, you'd be getting your ass kicked. So, you know, it's awareness of that. And you know, I think someone like Nadal, he's probably the best example of that. And that his sort of focus and intensity from start to finish, like it never wavers. And, you know, if you turned on the TV and you saw him, you wouldn't know what the score was. You wouldn't know if he's winning or losing just by the look that he's projecting on the court. And that's a massive skill to have, I think. And, you know, I wouldn't say I've always been the best at that, and sometimes still have, you know, rough days when things aren't going so well, and you know, you turn up and you know, you're stressed and you let the crowd know that. But in a way, it's like bluffing. You're bluffing to your opponent, you're bluffing to the crowd. And I mean, Federer's amazing like that as well. Like, he could hit the worst shot ever, but he always looks like he's in total control of what he's doing, almost like, yeah, I meant to do that shot, you know. That's it's all part of the show, and it's a huge talent to have. And you know, it's probably the biggest difference between being a champion and winning Grand Slams or being like 20 in the world, I think.
Beyond the last point and the lift of the trophy and the check, when you win at the US, when you win at Australia, when you win Wimbledon, what's it like? What does it do to you?
I don't know. I mean, I like when we won in Australia, it was our first Grand Slam. Like, I mean, I was really happy. I was probably relieved a bit as well, because I'd lost in the final of the previous two Grand Slams, and that match was like almost in the back of my head. It was like, you can't lose again. You know, that's gonna be three in a row. Will you ever win one? Like, you've obviously got doubts, but that was probably more relief. I think like I was super happy when we won the U.S. Open, because we'd played some like amazing tennis in the semi-finals and then in the final, and I don't know, it just felt like it was a bigger achievement for us. And I was super happy. But then I like came off the court, drug tested, get some food, go to the airport, fly home, because we were doing Davis Cup. So it wasn't like there was time to like, you know, relax and enjoy it. And I think that's sometimes a problem in tennis, because the season just keeps going and going and going. There's no break. Like, you don't always have a chance to reflect on your wins and just be in that moment, enjoying it for what it is. Like, because it is like, it is amazing achievement. But you know, it's like the next day the tournaments start again and everyone starts in the first round. So it's a weird kind of.
You might take 2-3 hours of enjoyment out of a Grand Slam win potentially.
Yeah, to be honest, in the times that I've won, it's kind of been like that. I mean, in Australia, we finished at like 1 a.m, came off court, straight into press conference, then get drug tested, you know, pee, blood, get a little bit of food that was kind of left over at the courts, and then we left the courts at like 3 a.m. And by that time, I was like smoked, you know, because all your adrenaline had worn off and wanted to go to bed, to be honest.
Shouldn't there be precisely the right type of food for that recovery? You should be
physio. It was champagne, I think. That was the recovery they were offering.
Okay, you're talking to somebody who might vote for that, but that's why I'm like me. And that's, you know, you go differently. You're elite, so it should be the right nutrients to replenish you. You're, like you say, you're on a plane, you're traveling. You should have a physio. Should have rubbed down after that.
Yeah,
prevent
probably.
Prevent cramps,
yeah.
Tears, sprains, no?
Yeah, I mean, I guess in that situation, it's the end of the tournament and it's like, okay, whatever, you know, gonna enjoy this. But I mean, normally, yeah, once we finish playing, you know, straight on the bike, cool down, get some food in you as quick as you can, massage or stretching, ice baths maybe as well, because you know you're always thinking about the next day, the next challenge, and all that. It's all part of the preparation, yeah, for that next match, and also like for longevity of your career, because if you're looking after yourself every day, then you're gonna squeeze out more years on the tour for sure. And you can see now in tennis, like the guys, they're lasting a lot longer because of all that sort of sports science side of it. Yeah, they're looking after themselves way better than probably.
What was Rafa saying the other day, that the doctors were saying to him 7 years ago, you know, you might not finish the season. Rafa was saying that basically he's been carrying a short physique because of his injuries for 10 years ago. It would have been over.
Yeah, potentially. Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, medicine, science, all that stuff. It's changing all the time. People are learning more and more things, new things, and you know, guys can recover better from injuries or surgeries. You know, I'm sure like 30 years ago, if you did your ACL or whatever, that was probably you done, wasn't it? But nowadays, yeah, people are back in like 5-6 months, ready to go again. And no loss of like speed or explosion or anything like that. So it just shows you like how much better all that stuff is. And it'll keep advancing as well. It's just the way the world's going.
One of the things I try to do when we talk to the elite footballers and they join in this discussion, particularly the ones who are playing Champions League, European tournament, trying to win the league, whether it be Germany, England, Spain, it's the relentlessness is there, but the burnout in terms of travel, in terms of no rest, no social time, the burnout in terms of probably too little family time, lack of sleep.
Yeah, see, when footballers started going on about that,
You just won't buy
it
either.
No, I think it's absolute nonsense.
Because I'm trying to let the listener buy into it now
and
pull the carpet.
I'm not having
okay,
that at all,
case,
yeah.
Okay, make a case.
Oh, because, I mean, I'm on the road 30 weeks a year.
Yeah.
So that's 30 weeks a year that I'm away from my family. Footballers, if they go to, okay, they're playing Champions League, which is how many group games? 6 group games.
Mm-hmm.
So that's 2 nights they're away, probably.
Usually 2, yeah.
Yeah, so that's 12 nights they're away from their family. And I'm away for at least 210.
Mm-hmm. Who hurt you, Jamie? Which Champions League?
No.
Some Champions League footballer had a little thing once.
But a lot of footballers say come out with that stuff, and the travel aspect for me, that's, I'm not buying that at all.
People won't understand. I think that if you know jet lag,
yeah,
loneliness, boredom,
yeah,
you're in a special art because you're lucky at the moment. You're York and Cole,
okay.
But partners in football tend not to like each other. They get on the pitch, they do their thing, and they genuinely, actually, normally, can't stand each other.
Yeah.
Now, in your game, you have to go through a lot of partners because natural change will happen, fallouts will happen, form will happen, injury will happen, whatever. But it's an extra burden to carry on the road if you're number one doubles in the world, because you have to get on, you have to be at the same level of form,
yeah,
you have to want the same things. I would say that aside from playing and winning and the mentality, there's a big burden you carry around to be at your level in tennis because of all those things.
Yeah, I mean,
or it's a test.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of getting on with your partner, it's kind of key in a way, because you know you spend all day with that guy because you're on the same schedule. So you know you're waking up at the same time, you're going to breakfast the same time. We're going to the courts at the same time. We're warming up together. We're in the gym together. Then we're waiting around for a match together. Then we're playing our match, which obviously, you know, a lot of stressful moments there, difficult moments, ups and downs, ebbs and flows of the match. And, you know, if you're at each other's necks, that's a lot harder to get through those, to get through those matches and, you know, win basically, which is, you know, that's the goal at the end of the day. I mean, I would say in football it's easier because there's more players, so you know, diluted. And I mean, on a football pitch is much bigger than a tennis court, so you know, you can be far apart, and maybe you're not stopping after each point to communicate with your partner. I mean, if you know, if we're centre forwards, and you know, I take a shot and put the ball out of field into row Z or whatever, you know, you might scream at me from 20 yards, but then we just run back to the...
If the keeper's shouting at you, you're not even listening.
Yeah, exactly.
And the way
yeah.
they speak, you probably won't be able to understand them
yeah.
anyway.
And I bet a lot of players that are on the opposite side from the field from the manager, they probably not listen at all, and they're just like, whatever.
Yeah. Right, Michael O'Neill changed sides whenever... If I remember correctly, if I understand it correctly, which I usually do, it was a Scot who took football to Brazil. But since that, in the 150 years since Scotland and Brazil, it's not a particularly normal mix.
No, no.
And I'm not talking about the distance. Like
totally different culture, isn't it?
So what the hell's going on, man? Tell us a little bit about Bruno. Has he got a touch? You played football?
You know what? We have played football a few times. Normally when we're at events and he's like the local football team. So like when we were in Shanghai last year, we had Sven-Goran Eriksson's team. They brought in Hulk.
Yeah, super player.
Another Brazilian guy. And we played like football tennis with them. But yeah, Bruno can play. Yeah, he's got some skills, I would say. Yeah.
How did Hulk do?
He was a beast, man. That guy is an absolute unit.
He's kind of like an oblong. Interviewed him up close and... Usually,
he's so strong.
In my feeling, when you look at footballers on the pitch, they look bigger, and they come up close, and you're like, "No, that's okay." He comes up close, and you're like, "Yeah." You know, you ask the questions. I'm not going to say.
He's a beast. Yeah, it's funny because I mean, I don't think they knew they were going to have to do it, and they'd turn up all, dressed up. I think he might even have been. He had like suit trousers and these like really designery shoes on. And in a shirt, and of course, then he's got like, there's a lot of people watching, and then I'm sure they're expecting like a show, And I think he was a bit.
Your boys turned him over a couple of times.
Yeah, I think he was feeling it because obviously he couldn't like really control the ball because of his shoes that he was wearing, and I think, he didn't speak English. If Bruno was speaking to him, I think he said he felt like he got stitched up a bit there.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Let's say there had to be, right, really important, some sort of ATP five-a-side team.
Okay.
Football, right? Clearly you're in it.
Absolutely, yeah.
Good right
pull it,
foot,
pulling the strings, yeah.
Pulling motion.
Orchestrating.
Yeah, yeah. maybe double Murray value, potentially? Andy?
Yeah, got to be, yeah. I think he's playing up front, yeah.
Reasonable footballer.
Yeah, Andy's good, yeah. He knows how to, like... shield the ball, it's not easy to get it off him.
Elbows?
But he'll good old fashioned centre forward, like they'll use their backside that sort
Dougley
of stuff.
Style.
Yeah, he knows his stuff.
See, listen, you both seem to be in the five-side team. What this I'm just looking at, there's a new Italian coming through, Maldini.
Yeah. He's playing today in a tournament.
Yeah.
5:30, incredible.
What the hell?
So he won. Quite often tournaments do that. They have like a local tournament and the winner gets a wild card into the event. And he won with his coach. So now he's playing challenger level, which is like one level below the main tour. And he's playing tonight on centre court.
Okay,
yeah.
So many questions. Like, would you pick a challenger tournament just to make sure that he got a doubles match with Paolo Maldini? Just...
I don't think I'd want to watch it really. I'd feel bad for him. And they put him on center court. Like there'll be a ton of people come out to watch. I'm sure it's in Milan as well. Like it's his city, and he's going to get turned over, which is a shame. I honestly hope he doesn't. And it's a great story, but I feel bad for him. Yeah.
Do you think there's any degree to which they've just slipped him an easy one because it's Paolo and he smells good and looks good and because
well, I mean,
if he was playing in a challenger tournament in Czechoslovakia or Poland, I'd say, well, he's probably had to work for that one. But
yeah.
It's Italy, it's local.
No, but I mean, one of my friends, he lives in Milan, and I text him when I saw the news about it on social media, and I sent it to him, and he sent me back a photo that he'd been playing with him that morning. And he was like super excited about it. So I'm sure he'll be down there watching him.
That's three of you in the five-side team. You got two more slots.
I mean, to pick my mates, I think. I'd pick Johnny Marry, who won Wimbledon a few years ago. He just retired, but he was a proper footballer. He's really good. And actually, probably my coach, Alan, who is like the fastest 38-year-old in the world for sure. He would... he'd get in the team, yeah. Seems decent. Might not be very good, but we'd have a good time though.
Listen, that's the main part of it.
Definitely, yeah.
Jamie Murray, thank you very much indeed.
No, thanks for having me.
What a pleasure.
Yeah.
We hope you enjoy Graham's chat with Jamie Murray. For more exclusive big interviews, including Rafa van der Vaart, Ledley King, and next month's chat with Robbie Keane, plus over 8 hours of ad-free content every month, join our social club at patreon.com/Graham Hunter.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.